kind of thing done in New York among, you know, did the Kinsey ever achieve that kind of importance for the New York Cuban community?
I really
it may well have been because of it being in Miami. And
yeah, I certainly have not heard about it being that much, you know. I certainly have not. None of the people that I know that have done research on that. Mm-hmm. Rogue's book might say something about it if it says, her new book is out. I have it inside on the West New York community. So, but I haven't read it as yet. But none of the people that I know that have worked on it have talked about it. I think what's more interesting, what's interesting too, is the Compadrasco thing and how that shifts or changes somewhat, you know.
What's that?
The ritual, you know, the godparent relationship, you know, yeah, mm-hmm. and to the degree to which that's maintained, which might also be.
We talked with people too about, you know, the New Year's Eve, the Cuban tradition of eating 12 grapes on New Year's, and it was interesting that some of it was retained, but some of it wasn't. You know, some of the younger Cubans said, oh yeah, there's something with the grapes, but I don't know what it is. You get a bunch of grapes, you know, you do something with them.
People saying, well, it's either 7 or 12, but they can't remember what it was.
Yeah. How have Caribbeans migrated? You mean by boat or by air? Is that what you don't literally mean how?
I don't mean literally how. I mean in terms of what different, which have been the main groups to migrate, where they come to. What particular events have set off migrations?
Yeah, they go home to visit.
Right, the ties to the homeland and people visiting back and forth. So,
yeah, okay.
Okay.
You ready to go?
Yeah. First of all, let me ask you to state your name and your position, training.
My name is Helen Safai. I'm director of the Center for Latin American Studies at the University of Florida and professor of anthropology. I have a doctorate in anthropology from Columbia University. And I've worked, starting before my doctoral dissertation, in Latin America and specifically in the Caribbean, and even more specifically that, and in that in Puerto Rico. My doctoral dissertation was on Puerto Rico, on the urban poor of Puerto Rico. And I've maintained my interest in that area ever since that period. I actually worked for the Puerto Rican government before starting my graduate work in anthropology at Columbia, and then pursued my graduate studies with a fellowship from the University of Puerto Rico, which was a rather unusual case. So I was scholarshiped by the Puerto Rican government rather than vice versa.
Dr. Safai, perhaps you could tell us, what does the Caribbean area include? How do people define it?
Well, the definitions vary. Generally, if someone says to me, just Caribbean, I tend to think of the island Caribbean, meaning the archipelagos, starting with Cuba, down through the Greater Antilles, the Lesser Antilles, and reaching on to the small islands off of the coast of Venezuela, the island Caribbean. In other definitions, people also talk about the Caribbean Basin or the Circum-Caribbean, which is often intended to include the coastal areas of Venezuela, Colombia, and sometimes portions of Central America and even Mexico. The reason for this being that these are also areas that are heavily influenced by slavery, plantation culture, and the presence of an Afro-American culture in these areas.
How does Florida, how does our state fit into it?
Our state fits into it, I think, in that in many ways, geographically and in terms of climate, and to a certain degree in terms of history, it shares a great deal with the Caribbean. We know, for example, that in the pre-Columbian era, Indian groups actually either came from Florida into Cuba, or also went from Cuba into Florida. I would say, though, that culturally, up until recent times, the people of Florida were actually quite different from the people of the Caribbean. It's true that one also had a black population in Florida, but it was not necessarily that for which Florida was known. But that I think with the recent migration of Caribbean and other Latin American peoples, particularly into South Florida, has begun to share actually much more culturally with the rest of the Caribbean.
When did these migrations begin?
Oh, these migrations, as I mentioned just a moment ago, actually started in the pre-Columbian era. And there's a great deal of movement back and forth even throughout the colonial period. We know that people like Alexander Hamilton were, born in the Caribbean. To this day, leaders of the Black Power movement in the 1960s, like Stokely Carmichael and so on, were also born in the Caribbean. But it's interesting that, for example, though there were West Indians that were influential in the growth of the Black Power movement in the U.S., the Black Power movement in the Caribbean was something that was really carried from the U.S. back to the Caribbean. So you have this constant, it's sometimes very difficult to know where to break the cycle, where something begins and something ends, because there's this constant circulation of people, ideas, goods, products, and everything else back and forth.
Well, let me ask you.
Many of the slave populations, I should add, were also very often slave populations that had been in the Caribbean and then were brought to the U.S., and there's been some studies done on the difference between those slave, sort of pre-season slave populations versus those who came directly from Africa.
So there's the kinds of migration that took place, sort of forced migration with the slave.
That's right. I mean, the Gullah dialect, for example, of the Sea Islands in Georgia, can still be traceable to basically Caribbean origins, see, and where it was preserved because of the marginal geographic nature of these islands.
What about in the 20th century?
Migrations? Well, the biggest wave of migration, you have migrations really. A substantial migration going back to the end of the 19th century, I would say, particularly of Cubans in Tampa, Key West, many of whom played a key role in the independence movement in Cuba. And here I'm not talking just of elites like Martí himself, who is probably the best known, but of workers who actually also participated in and supported very heavily the Cuban independence movement. You also have Puerto Ricans going to New York in the earliest 20th century. Some of this material is now only beginning to be uncovered with books like the Memorias de Bernal Vega, for example, and their relationship with Cubans, for example, and the two of them, two groups, Puerto Ricans and Cubans, in many cases working together for the independence of their respective islands. But still, that was a fairly small group in comparison to other populations. The end of the 19th century and the early 20th century is primarily known in the U.S. as the era of great European migrations. So that if one had to characterize certain periods, one would say that it's the era in the post-war period that is primarily known as the era of Caribbean migrations. And even that, up until recently, was in a sense overshadowed by Mexican migration, primarily into the Southwest and parts of the Midwest. But now there's increasing attention being paid to Caribbean migration, which has been largely, contrary to the Mexican migration, confined to the eastern seaboard.
Mm-hmm. And when you say post-war, you mean?
Post-Second World War, right, in the period after the Second World War, and particularly starting in the 1950s. You start in the 1950s with a very large Puerto Rican migration, okay, which was there before. There was an old-time group there before the war. But one of the things that happened also after the war was that facilitated migration was the improvement in transportation. Constant air shuttles used to go by boat back to Puerto Rico, and that slowed people up. West Indians at that point were still largely going to England. Okay. And so there again, where you had an older West Indian community in New York, particularly in Brooklyn, it wasn't until England closed its doors to West Indians that you began to get a much more massive migration of West Indians into the United States. And that is primarily in the period of the mid-60s. So we have Puerto Rican migration in the 50s. West Indian migration starting very heavily in the 60s, the Cuban migration into Florida in the early 60s due primarily to the Castro Revolution in Cuba, so that you might not want to call it a migration, but they were there. And then now, more recently, of course, the huge Cuban and Haitian influx into South Florida in the 1980s.
What's been the main cause of the most recent influx of Cubans and Haitians?
Well, that question is still debatable. It's not as easily answered as some might think. There are those who would like to say, well, the Cubans come for political reasons and Haitians come for economic reasons. And it's been that basis on which they have tried to send some Haitians back and deny them status as political refugees. You know, that is a very controversial issue actually in the courts at the moment, because there are those who maintain that Haitians as well are political refugees fleeing from a repressive regime of Duvalier. Although it's clear from the nature of the migration, the fact that most of these are very unskilled, sometimes illiterate migrants, that there are economic reasons for their migration as well. I think, again, in the Cuban case, it is clear that their primary reason for leaving is political, that is, dissatisfaction with the present Castro socialist government in Cuba. But I think that there, again, it's not so simple, and one can argue that part of their dissatisfaction is economic as well as political, that is, that they felt they did not have enough chance to get ahead, to be rewarded, to become upwardly mobile, all of the kind of values that we emphasize in this culture in under a socialist regime.
Did you have anything to add?
Well, I was just going to say that do you see any great difference between this new influx of refugees or migrants from the Caribbean and the fact that the Cuban community was so well established in Miami before? Do you see any differences, say, that the Haitians...
In the most recent one. You mean in this most recent one? Because one can also talk about a Cuban community in Miami prior to the 1960s. Yes, no, I think there's unquestioned difference in that. I think that the it is much easier for the most recent Cuban refugees, often referred to as the Marielitos, because of the fact that there is an established Cuban community in Miami, a community that is also able to absorb many of these immigrants. So that, for example, on the simple question of language, many Cubans can find work within the Cuban community and therefore are not as handicapped by lack of knowledge of the language as Haitians would be. There is also a Haitian community in Miami, as you well know, but they're not the kind that can even offer employment to their compatriots. So they're a much poorer community. On the other hand, I think it also has to be acknowledged that there has been considerable rejection also of the Marielitos by some elements in the Cuban community, so that they're not being absorbed perhaps at the rate that they might have been had they been more characteristically like the earlier Cuban migrants. The recent group has been of lower socioeconomic background and has had a larger percentage of blacks in their population. They correspond much more closely to a cross-section of the Cuban population than the earlier migrants had, who were predominantly middle and upper class and white.
Mm-hmm.
in composition.
Can you tell us a little bit about the cultural history of the Caribbean area, and just sort of sketch it for us?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are at least three main components to the Caribbean area in terms of cultural history. One that has received increasing recognition recently is the African heritage of the Caribbean. This is numerically certainly the strongest population, and is formed primarily, although not exclusively, of slaves, of former slaves. There were some blacks who were also brought over by Africans, who were brought over by the Spaniards, who were not in slave status and so on, but they're relatively small. So that they're primarily people who were brought over under slavery and suffered under the institution of slavery and then the plantation system that grew up under that and actually persisted even after the end of slavery for a certain period. So we have an African heritage, and there's been a lot of work done by people like Herskovitz and others on the question of the African heritage. There's a lot of renewed interest in that, but it is interesting, too, that the new interest does not take a completely Herskovitz line, in that he was trying to trace direct culture traits from the Caribbean to Africa. The interest now is much more in terms of seeing how a certain worldview and values have tended to condition African and hence Caribbean worldviews, rather than looking at specific cultural traits. The dominant culture within that was always the European culture, even though the number of white Europeans living in these islands was quite small, particularly in the West Indies, and here I'm speaking to the English-speaking islands. It was larger in the Hispanic-speaking islands, and that has made a difference in terms of cultural identity, in terms of language, in terms of religion, which are still extremely important to this day, to the extent that one can speak at least of various kinds of Caribbean cultures, Hispanic, West Indian, Dutch speaking, and so on, based primarily on their cultural ties and so on with the colonial power that governed them at the time. Most of these islands, as we know now, have achieved their independence, so there are a few, particularly of the French-speaking islands, that still remain part of metropolitan France, for example, but have representation in the French Parliament. So that the European culture was the dominant, but the African was the numerically superior. And then one has also to add, and there's been also considerable interest in the older pre-Columbian Indian cultures, the Siboney, the Taino, the Arawak, and so on, many of whom were largely wiped out by the colonizers who came, either through enslavement, through disease, and so on. There was an incredibly fast reduction of the Indian population because of these factors. But they do continue to play some importance in terms of certain words in the language, certain crops that are grown, certain items in the diet, and one could argue even in perhaps in other aspects of culture.
Are there any distinctively Caribbean languages or Caribbean religions?
Well, yes, I would say that the Caribbean religions reflect the culture of the area, and that is that they are hybrid forms, so that you find hybrid forms of Catholicism that such as Shango in Haiti or Santeria in Cuba and so on, which are both where some would actually object and say that these are not hybrid forms of Catholicism, that they're actually perhaps hybrid forms of African religions. It's difficult to say. My point on this would be, again, going back to the question of Herskovitz, that none of these are direct transplants, but that they represent new fusions, new cultures that have grown up in the New World that are owe a certain element to both African and European religions, but represent a new culture in their own right, and new religions, therefore, in their own right, although the cultural indebtedness is undoubtedly there.
Do Haitians call their religion Shango?
No, they call it Vodun, or Vodou. Vodou as we use, but Vodun is the Haitian term for that, right?
Yes. But it's probably very similar to, like, Trinidadian...
Shango, right. I'm sorry, I meant to say of Trinidad. I'm sorry, corrected me on that, yes.
Well, I just wondered,
and there's, again, an interesting now in Trinidad, which is considered, and now is primarily in English-speaking, but it was also under Spanish control for a while, and this is, so that you won't find, this is not, in other words, this is a type of religion, varieties of which are found throughout the Caribbean, and as well in northeastern Brazil, as you well know.
And this is also reflected in the language?
The hybrid nature of the culture? Yes, I would say that the example par excellence of that is probably Papamiento in the Dutch-speaking islands, which is a mixture of like four or five different languages, okay, so that... And you find the incredible thing on these small islands of people being fluent in English and Dutch and Spanish at the same time speaking their own language, which is Papamianda. And I would say that one could even argue that even some of the, there's an argument raging now about the kind of Spanish that is spoken in the Caribbean, and more particularly the kind of Spanish that is growing up among the migrants. I mean, this is what kind of Spanish does a New Yorker speak, and does that represent then a fusion between English and Spanish? And there are real arguments going on as to whether that represents a new and valued form of hybrid vigor, as an anthropologist would call it, or is it a form of deculturation? It's seen, and there's a heated controversy going on among Puerto Ricans themselves on this particular point. And I'm sure the same thing will eventually happen with Cuban Spanish as it's spoken in the United States.
And with Haitian...
Yeah, well, the Haitian Creole, of course, is, again, has its roots in the French language, but a person who understood French would not necessarily and would not understand Creole. It would help him perhaps to learn the language, to know French, but it would not necessarily, he would not, it's, they're not mutually intelligible.
Also the different forms of Creole, it's true that there are several different Creoles, or if you were in Louisiana, for instance,
mm-hmm.
a form of Creole.
Right. I heard this question debated among people from Haiti, Guadeloupe, Martinique. I gather they can speak to each other, but I think that I heard an interesting conversation of this kind, which included someone from Quebec, and the only way they could converse with each other was in standard French. But that's true, you see, that's not so odd. I mean, I've myself, being of German background, I've known of cases of people that speak dialects in Germany, and they could only converse with each other in speaking standard German. They would not be able to understand each other if each spoke their dialect. And it's a reflection of the fact that in the Caribbean one has had a great deal of movement between peoples, and a great deal of commingling of cultures.
What, to completely switch the change the subject, is the agricultural situation in the Caribbean? What's this food preparation system based on?
I would say that in the area of food, particularly, as in religion, is another area in which you can find a great deal of retention of African African lifestyles. And I think that this, again, is due primarily to the to slavery and to the way that slaves lived. They were very often required to provide their own food supply. They were not provided that by the master. They would be given a plot of ground and said, grow your own food. And what they grew, or what they tried to grow, were crops either that were exactly like the ones they had grown in Africa, or were similar, which meant that you had a great deal of emphasis on root crops. And many of the root crops were then adapted from the Indian heritage. So you have this mixture of Indian and African black culture occurring in the root crops. Again, as one of your informants, I'm very bad at remembering names on these particular, but I know that the African roots, and the other reason that this is important is because they're very high in starches and carbohydrates, and they fill people up. And they are also very well adapted to the terrain in the Caribbean, because they're not they're the least subject to hurricane and flooding and other kinds of disasters. So that you have these the food crops that are basically, I would say, primarily of either Indian and African origin, and a mixture of the two, as a part of the domestic economy. The export economy, of course, is quite different. You had sugar being brought in first to the northeast of Brazil and then traveling throughout the Caribbean, and I mean literally traveling, because as one island became exhausted or gained its independence or there was labor unrest or a variety of things, they simply moved to another island. Part of this also due to soil erosion. The Hispanic islands, particularly Cuba and Puerto Rico, were one of the last, actually, for sugar to take hold, and one of the last to import slaves for the sugar economy. And this is basically what slavery was introduced for, was labor for the sugarcane plantations. On the other hand, you also had other export crops like tobacco, which were of indigenous origin as well.
I'm curious, though, as an anthropologist, talking to, on the radio show, this will be people who haven't thought maybe about culture and even things in their own lives that are important. How would you say food and food preparation and specific recipes, how does that function in a migrant community? Or does it have a function?
Yes, I think it does, because I think that it is one area in one which one can see certain retention of certain cultural values. Particularly since food is so much associated with the family and with the whole idea of the hearth and the home, and that particularly on festivals and celebrations and rites of passage, one would want to have this celebrated with particular native foods, whether it be a barbecued pig or a chicken of some kind and so on, and again these root crops that I have mentioned earlier. So that I think, yes, there is. And one of the things that I think you find reflected is that one could also even do a study of migrant populations by seeing the changes in the kind of food that is sold in supermarkets, or more particularly in open-air markets and so on. One can certainly see that reflected in New York, and I'm sure that that's increasingly true of Miami as well. So that by catering again to the consumer preferences of these migrant populations, the food patterns of the United States as well become changed to some degree, as much as we also tend to change them. But there again, I think we have to recognize that many of these food patterns, I mean, I don't think there's a Caribbean migrant who's ever come to the United States who has not had Coca-Cola, for example. And that's not, that's not due so much to migration as the fact that, again, these consumer goods have gone there in a very massive way.
Can you tell us a little bit about how Caribbean migrants have acculturated or not acculturated in the U.S.?
Well, I would make a distinction between acculturation and assimilation. I think that there has been a degree of acculturation, and by that I mean taking on some of the cultural traits, some of the values of the U.S. host society. You can see this again by looking at aspects such as language, learning English, food habits, some changes in food habits, much more clearly in questions when one gets into questions of intermarriage and so on. But looking at when you look at a question like intermarriage, then you're getting more into what I would call assimilation, or what Michael Gordon's famous book, which is now cited by everyone, he distinguishes between cultural assimilation and structural assimilation. Cultural assimilation is much more like what we used to call acculturation, precisely taking on values, ideologies, and also traits of the native culture. That, and he has maintained, and I think he's right, that cultural assimilation takes place before structural assimilation. Structural assimilation means really participating in the society. And here I'm talking about not just having jobs going to school or going to a health center, all of which are sort of institutional kinds of characteristics, but also participating in clubs. The primary context that is people among your close family and friends being not just members of your own ethnic group, but people from the whole society. I would say that degree of structural assimilation has only occurred for a small segment of Caribbean migrants, and primarily the segment that tends to be largely middle class, highly acculturated, live in suburban neighborhoods, where they have the opportunity, really, much more of developing these kind of primary group ties with members of the host society, which most members of ethnic ghettos do not simply have the opportunity. They are excluded from this possibility. As a matter of fact, it's because of Caribbean migrants, and to a certain degree also our own Afro-American group, that the whole theory of assimilation has been challenged, and there have been arguments that these groups might better be seen as internal colonies, or as Alejandro Portes has called them, as economic enclaves, rather than as groups, that these groups are basically non-assimilable. One can use such a term. I think that varies, too. I mean, I think that, again, there is assimilation that occurs in the middle class, but it occurs at an individual rather than on a group basis, and therefore is not as visible.
If we turn the question around, then, what we're really talking about is maintaining a Caribbean or an island identity in our...
Yes, but I think it's a little different. It's a little more complicated than that, because I don't think it's just a question of maintaining. I think the first generation that comes, yes, maintains a strong tie with wherever they've come from, and it may not even be particularly with all of Puerto Rico. It may be with Utuado or Fajardo or San Germán in particular place, and I'm thinking also of Cuban migrants in the same way. But their primary identification is with that, and their intention is very often to come for a certain period and go back. And when that doesn't happen, and you begin to get a second generation that is born in the United States and grows up, is still with a sense of being a hyphenated American, a Cuban American, or Puerto Rican American, or a Haitian American. Then I think one begins to question. I don't think that the ties that are maintained or the culture that grows up is necessarily just a transplant. It is, as I said before, in terms of language and food preferences and religion even, a new kind of culture that grows up that is not a direct transplant of the island culture, nor is it totally assimilated within the U.S. culture.
What kind of a role would such things as seasonal celebrations or rites of passage play in that kind of new culture?
I think that the seasonal celebrations and the rites of passage and so on serve really to reaffirm that ethnic identity, because celebrations particularly, and here I'm thinking not just of things like Carnival or New Year's or Christmas and so on, but also of Puerto Rican Day parades or West Indian street festivals and so on, cultures, festivals that are particularly specific to that group, serve to reaffirm a form of group identity in collective consciousness. That is extremely important for the maintenance of that collective identity. The rites of passage function primarily for that, but at the family level, the family and kin level, rather than at the larger group level for maintaining that kind of identity. My suspicion also would be, and I don't know if there have been studies done to affirm this, but I would hypothesize that there are far more people who maintain this at the family level that do not necessarily participate in the larger collective gatherings.
For example, the Calle Ocho festival in Miami might not draw as many people as would, say, continue the family level.
That's right.
The Cuban way of getting married or the Cuban way of...
That's right. Yeah, I would argue. Although you probably also have people participating in the Calle Ocho festival who may have dropped some of these other familial patterns, but I would judge that, again, one tended to see this in stages, because I think one always has to see culture as process. It's not a static phenomenon. And if one had tended to see it as stages, I would say that the there are far more people that would participate in these collective groups than... it's just the opposite. There are far more people who would participate in these activities and rites of passage at the family level than would participate in these larger collective gatherings. I mean, I can think of groups even that may not even want to be consciously identified with even the group, but would maintain certain rites of passage within the confines of the family, because it's not going as public either as well. In terms of declaring your identity, you're doing it within the confines of the family.
What kinds of traditions, from what you've been able to see, tend to be maintained, say, over other ones?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question to observe, because many of the celebrations they have, because we're dealing basically with a Western people, so that many of the traditions they maintain, like Christmas or New Year's or even Easter, are very much the same as our own celebrations. It's the difference in the way that they are celebrated that makes them different. Okay, because I can remember Easter in Puerto Rico as being, the emphasis was always on the despair and the suffering of Christ on the cross, whereas Easter for ourselves, at least within a Protestant tradition that I grew up, was looked at as a time of hope and joy and so on. And true, that also happens in Puerto Rico on the Sábado de Gloria on that Saturday. But there seems to be far more emphasis on the whole week of the suffering than we tend to place on that. And then they have certain other things like the Epiphany, what we call it, which is called Los Reyes on the 6th of January, which again we have, but we tend to forget within our calendar. Whereas in the Caribbean, and this is interestingly enough also even true in the West Indies, Christmas basically starts the beginning of December and runs through the 6th of January, where it becomes a whole month long, really, of celebrations.
It's interesting from what you've said. Do you feel that in the Caribbean, these seasonal celebrations, I'm thinking about what Easter means and what Christmas means in the United States. Christmas means Santa Claus, Easter means Easter Bunny and eggs.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think in the Caribbean the church plays a bigger role in how celebrations are maintained and what kinds of things are important?
You're asking me if the church plays a larger role in the Caribbean in these festivals? I would say that differs, because I think there are certain groups in the United States for which the church is also extremely important within these festivals. Now, I would say it's mostly at the level of folk tradition that there is a great difference, and there perhaps is more participation by peoples in the church when the church speaks their language and so on. But then again, we also have that phenomenon now also happening in the United States, that we have Spanish-speaking churches, or at least Spanish-speaking masses occurring within the church. I think, yes, you have a greater phenomenon of it being much more of a communal festivity in the Caribbean, because it's not They are not migrants. It's not. It's, this is part of their own culture.
What part do performing arts play, like ballet and dance and, well, not ballet, but say just dance in general, mm-hmm. and music and...
Well, they're, I think theater. They're, yeah, well, again, I think that within this area there's been a real renaissance within the Caribbean recently, emphasizing, again, interesting enough, primarily the Afro-American heritage. Again, for a long time, they looked to Europe as a model for that, for these performing arts, and I think there's been an increasing interest recently in looking at Afro-American dance, poetry, rhythmic forms, and so on, and this has led to a considerable a renaissance in this area in the Caribbean.
What part do these things play, do you think, in say, among Caribbeans in this country, in their new culture?
That's an interesting point. I think it begins to grow up, but I think that, again, is a question of process, and it takes time. I think only in the last 5 to 10 years do one begin to find, for example, among Puerto Ricans in New York, certainly in the last 10 years, yes, development of a literature of their own, of a theater of their own, and so on. Certainly there were certain isolated groups, but in terms of there being a proliferation of groups and where they could actually begin to exchange with one another and have a whole festival on the basis of that, that has only happened in the last 5 years. To my knowledge, it's only beginning to happen now in Miami, and I think that's partly due, again, to the length of time the people have been here. I think it takes some time for these performing arts groups to take root within the new host society. And here I'm thinking now particularly of performing arts groups that are part of the migrant experience. There's also always the question of bringing groups from the Caribbean, and that has been done. But I'm thinking of performing arts groups particularly who are, you know, as I say, who have grown up within the U.S. society.
What about such things as music or song that gets transferred through families, just in the home?
Yeah, no, that certainly has happened. And everything from lullabies and nursery rhymes to children's games and so on, that certainly, yes, are transferred within the home as well, as part of an oral tradition very often. That's true.
Are there some new sort of, I suppose call them acculturated traditions, or say traditions that are part of this new culture which might be either completely new or great transformations from the way they used to be in the home islands?
You're thinking here now, for example, of the Quinceañera and so on. This is a celebration on a girl's 15th birthday. Which was really marked in Catholic circles in terms of this becoming a measure of ascension to adult status. It meant the girl had reached puberty, was ready to be married if necessary, and so on. And it was primarily, I think, a function that took place among family and kin, to accept the girl as an adult member of the family now. And from what I gather, has taken on much more of a public rather than a private nature within certain elements in the migrant community. And that is, it's been seen as a vehicle for conspicuous consumption, much as weddings and other kinds of phenomena, in which the parents really are displaying their newfound wealth, as well as, you know, introducing their daughter to society. So it's taken on more of a public aspect and less of a private one. Perhaps due also is to the dispersal of kin that happens within a migrant community. And I think that there's also some aspect of acculturation there. I think that the Quinceañera is taking on some aspects of a bar mitzvah or a bas mitzvah in that aspect. But one has also then to look at how the bas mitzvah became transformed from its origins within Eastern Europe and so on, and how it also took on aspects of conspicuous consumption, which it certainly did not have traditionally.
Speaking along that same What about Santeria in Miami, say, as compared to in Cuba? You can speak to the differences or the similarities? Or? Oh.
I think that it's interesting that Santeria has taken root within Miami to the degree that it has, particularly when one considers that both prior to the revolution and certainly even after the revolution, for a long period, it was persecuted and even declared illegal and so on, and was certainly very much seen as a phenomenon of the lower classes. And from what I gather, it spread, you know, participants in Santeria are by no means simply of lower socioeconomic origin, although I imagine the practitioners are largely of lower socioeconomic, those who actually conduct the riots. I think that this is a reflection of two things. One, it's again a question of cultural retentions going back, but I think it's also an extremely important reflection of the stresses that a migrant community undergoes, and an attempt at finding some answers and some relief, if nothing else, a refuge from these stress conditions.
I know we have talked to several practitioners in Miami, and they're by no means of the lower socioeconomic factor anymore. I mean, it's kind of more, you know, branched out in a way. And one of the other things they told us was that it's so much more open in Miami. I mean, it's not like you have to have a front store in Cuba, say, because it was illegal. And of course, that you can do anything you want in America if it's religious freedom.
But now, was Santeria illegal in Cuba before the revolution?
It always was, but the degree to which it was actually, implemented this was varied by different periods. But there was a period, and that's interesting too, there was a period in which the Santeria was, under the Castro Revolution, was persecuted as much as some of the more standard religions, and perhaps even more so, and sort of forced to go underground. There has been a change in heart on that, on the part of the Cuban government, and that it is now, there's an attempt to bring it much more out into the open, and to give it a certain status as a sort of valid aspect of, and they now have a museum outside Havana dedicated to Santeria material and so on. So that, yes, there's been an attempt to legitimize its status, is what I would call primarily. Much as there has also been a kind of change in heart in terms of the attitude towards official religions in Cuba. Again, that there's not certainly not an attempt to encourage people to go to church, but there is no attempt to disqualify them in some way or to punish them if they should be gone. I happened to be in Cuba during Christmas of 1977, and that was interesting because one could, you know, again, one could see people going to Mass and so on, but there was no public announcement of Masses. There were no visible Christmas symbols up in the streets and so on. And in fact, one of the ones that I did see, which was very interesting, was must have been an old pre-revolutionary sign, I guess, of a Santa Claus, you know, pinned to a wall, but someone had painted Fidel's face in place of the Santa Claus. So you had this whole horde of goodies coming in, but it was Fidel who was bringing them. So in that sense, it was very symbolic, and they were quite willing to go public with this kind of symbol.
Well, there was a point at which Castro was actually against Catholicism.
That's true, yes. Well, I mean, taking an official kind of Communist Party line on that, although it's true that in many parts of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union itself, as we know, there is not a again, there's no public support for religion, certainly, and there's not encouragement for it, but there is also not, it's not declared illegal. I mean, one has only to look at Poland now to see this. And so I think that there's been a moving away from a hard line on religion, as well as on standard religions, as well as on cult groups like Santeria.
Well, I have one last question that I can think of, and then Peggy might.
Protestantism, I should mention, also was very, very much persecuted in there. You know, one of the problems was that also almost all the Protestant ministers left the island after the revolution, as did many of the Catholic priests, so that was also a problem for maintaining it. But there have been some who have stayed and whom I met when I was there, and again have been able to come to terms with the revolution, Protestant minister.
When was that at its worst?
I would say that in the period immediately after, and particularly after the declaration of the Cuban Revolution being a Marxist-Leninist revolution. I would say that in the early days of revolution was with the period in which one found really the least tolerance for any form of deviation on any level. Understandably.
For sure. What would you say is the, if you had to make a prediction for the sort of the fate of Caribbean's migrant groups in the U.S. now, what would you say it would be? Are they likely to go towards, say, complete assimilation, or are they likely to maintain their enclave identity for a long time?
I certainly don't think they're going to move towards complete assimilation. I think you're going to find assimilation only on the part of a select group of largely middle-class, white-skinned, primarily Hispanic migrants, those who learn the language. Someone who's going to be like this famous book, a fairly well-known book that has been published recently by Richard Rodriguez called Hunger of Memory. Anyone interested should look at this book. It was a Chicano, but who no longer identifies as a Chicano because as a result of his university education in the United States and in Europe and so on, it felt that in order to become part of the elite in the United States, he could no longer retain even an element of Chicano identity. And it's interesting to read that book because it's, on the one hand, one can profoundly disagree with it, and I certainly do at one level. On the other hand, I think it's clear from reading his words the pain and the alienation that position also confers. Where he really, it's a sense of you cannot go home again, and he means that literally in terms of his parents. I mean, he's really lost touch with them at a certain level. So that, yes, I think you're going to find many Richard Rodriguez's among the Cuban community particularly, and I think you already find them in the Puerto Rican and West Indian community. I think that for the large mass of migrants, however, assimilation will not be easier, or is it necessarily desired? And that's, I think, an important point, that we have not only to look at the U.S. society, how United States society regards them or treats them, but what migrants themselves want. And I think particularly in the second generation, one is beginning to find quite the opposite of the Richard Rodriguez phenomenon, rather than a returning to one's roots, a desire to renew reaffirm one's ethnic identity. And that this consists, however, not just in simply going back to the island and rediscovering one's history, and so on, all of which is important and sometimes even involves the whole question of re-looking at African origins and so on. But that there's also a new appreciation of the kind of culture that has grown up on the mainland among these migrants. And I think that's also partly a reflection of the fact, and this is interesting, that certainly this has perhaps been best documented among the Puerto Rican migrants, but that those where you've had considerable return migration, to Puerto Rico, particularly in the starting in the 1970s, so that there was a period in which the number of Puerto Ricans returning to the island seemed to be even larger than those leaving the island, not necessarily always the same people. But these return migrants, when they come, particularly if they don't speak Spanish or they don't speak Spanish well, and there's a whole community there called Levittown where they've had introduced bilingual education programs in order to teach Puerto Rican Spanish, and they have they again have suffered the whole problem of reentry, okay, and so that they are looked on as New Yorican and not Puerto Rican, and I think part of the reaction to that has been to say, hey, look, you know, we're not all that bad and all right. We may not be like you, but we in other words, it has led to a question of questioning what is it that we have in New York and is it all that bad and do we have to necessarily go back to Puerto Rico to look at our roots or to Jamaica or Trinidad or Cuba.
Are there any differences that you see between migrant culture, say, in New York and in Miami?
Yes, I think in New York, because you have a longer history of migration, I think there's much more awareness of cultural identity, much greater feeling of being at ease. This is with the exception, perhaps, of the Cuban group. That in the Cuban case, and I would argue that the Cuban case is very special because they came with a very strong sense of identity, because they came with the idea that they weren't certainly here temporarily and they were going back as soon as they could overthrow Fidel. So that I think that actually in the Cuban case you find quite the opposite of the other, where there was a strong period of initial strong collective identity and consolidation. I think I'm using an Hispanic term in English, which has become the community has actually become more diffuse and in a sense more fragmented with a period of time, whereas in the Puerto Rican case I think it has taken a long period for this collective identity to assert itself. So that again, I think that the Cuban identity will reassert itself, but again in a new way, in terms of asserting itself not simply as Miami being North Havana, but in terms of a whole new culture. And I think that in both cases you're going to see it, but it's following quite different paths. And so that I would argue, to answer your original question by way of a long deviation, I would say it's assimilation, yes, for some, maintenance of ethnic tradition, which is actually fueled by the fact that this migration is quite different from others by people, the circulatory nature of the migration, and the fact that the new people are always coming in to infuse this group, all with the exception, again, of the Cuban migration, where there has been very little possibility of return for the Cubans, but certainly new waves have continued to come in. So I would say the primary option is the third one, really, of a sort of intermediate status that's going to grow up with a new a Caribbean culture that is new to the and new to the mainland and new to the U.S., really. And among some groups, I think there's also an increasing interest in beginning to develop a kind of pan-Caribbean culture, which I think owes a great deal to the migrant experience, actually. I think that this is largely at this point confined to intellectual, academic circles, writers and artists and so on that are beginning to exchange more. So you're beginning to get much greater exchange between, say, the Hispanic and the English-speaking islands. But I think it's beginning to grow up, particularly around the issue of race. Race, I think, is becoming the phenomenon of blackness is becoming an important unifying force among Caribbean peoples and uniting them as well to Black Americans. That, not to argue that we have one great homogeneous picture, by no means. There's still bitter arguments. But I think at a certain intellectual level it is happening.
What is the difference, would you say, is there a different feel about Miami for Caribbean?
Yes, that's another point I've got, and I'm glad you reminded me of that, because I think there, in addition to the fact that you have a much longer tradition of Caribbean migration to New York, and as well, I think New York has been a city of immigrants par excellence, and it has developed a capacity to absorb these newcomers in a way that I find just phenomenal. Every time I go back there, I'm struck again by this, because you find, again, new groups coming in and new neighborhoods. I mean, a Chinatown that has just flourished in the last, again, 5 to 10 years, a renewed Chinatown. And yet somehow New York is able to absorb this without ever feeling that it's going to lose its identity as New York. Whereas in Miami, I think there's been a much greater fear that all of these migrants coming in are somehow, as one woman said it recently in a PBS broadcast, you know, forcing us to change, that we're becoming the minority. And there's a feeling of being overwhelmed by this in Miami, which I never got quite the degree of that. It's true that there was some expression of this in the 1950s in New York when the Puerto Rican migrants came in, but by no means the degree of backlash and resentment that happened in New York. And I think it has to do with something that I can only best call the absorptive capacity of the two communities in Miami, perhaps because it in itself is a newer city, is not able to absorb groups as well as New York has been able to.
Are Caribbeans numerically a larger part of the population?
I don't think so. Yeah, I mean, I think, yes, if you looked just at Dade County, yes, they probably are. I mean, I would have to look at the figures to compare Dade County with Manhattan. And,